Okay, so hi, this is Luke, the best guy from Teenager's Attitude. You know me. You hear him and he goes, yep, that's the best guy. I was looking into shows that we could do for April Fool's next year, like how we did that hilarious Friends episode that I came up with where it turned out I was in a coma all along. It was a great idea that I thought of, and I'm welcome. And so are you. Anyway, we bat around a lot of show ideas. I thought going back to the 90s sitcom well was boring, so we were looking at, like, what about American Horror Story? What about I Love Lucy? What about Knight Rider? What about The Walking Dead? Or, you know, something like that. And at some point, I forget who originally suggested it, but we thought, why don't we do an episode on Jeopardy? I did the math. It would be episode 87 of Jeopardy, which would have been back in 1985. If you don't count the original Art Fleming run of the show and only look at the Alex Trebek episodes, which I'll get to why we're doing that in a second. Okay, so backing up a second, I haven't gotten a ton of sleep this week, and I should have gone to bed like an hour and a half ago. This might only be funny to me. Fuck you. I don't care. It's going up anyway. You downloaded it. That's all I give a shit about. Alright. I'm just gonna stop and take a breath here. Okay. Everyone thought it'd be a really funny idea to do Jeopardy. Because who the fuck would do a rewatch podcast about Jeopardy? And then we realized the logistical issue, which is, of course, that why would anywhere have archived a random episode of a game show from 1985? Was it 85 or 86? I don't know. I've got some sources that, let's try and keep things sequential. I'll tell you about my sources. We started doing some digging to find if we could find this episode. So far, no luck, but I did find my new favorite website, which is jarchive.com, that's j-archive.com, which has comprehensive statistics and play-by-plays of every episode of Jeopardy since Alex Trebek took over the show. It's fucking incredible. They've got so many statistics, and they've got, like, someone, like, 10 years ago made an HTML table of the question board from Jeopardy for each episode, and it has data on, like, here's the question, here's what the correct answer was, here's what all the incorrect answers given by contestants were, you know, here's the dollar value, here's the order it came up on the show, here's random things that might have been said by a contestant or Alex Trebek while this question was being posed. It's amazing. It is so insanely comprehensive. And then you go a little deeper on it, right? And let's see, we've got... So, the episode in question is... they've got a list of show 456. I don't know why, because it's definitely the 87th episode. It was the premiere of season 3 that aired September 8th, 1986. And it had three contestants. Sandra Cheltenham, Florence Cohen, and Susan Sackett. And, like I said, so in addition to all of those statistics about the questions and the progression of the game on that episode, you can also click on each of these contestants and get a lot of statistics on how they performed according to metrics maintained by the Jeopardy fan community. And I love that that is a sentence I could just say. And this is not anything. This is me rambling into a microphone at what is functionally 2 a.m. for me. Even though it's 9:30 a.m. because I'm on a night sleep. I'm a reverse boy sleep schedule thing. Doesn't matter. Listen, they've got... the score that a contestant earned on Jeopardy, the score they earned in Double Jeopardy, the score they earned on the Final Jeopardy, something that they call the Coriat score. We'll get back to that in a second. Number of right questions, number of wrong questions. Something that just says REBS, R-E-B-S. I don't know what they are, but Susan Sackett has one of those. how many daily doubles they got, how much money they gained or lost in the daily double, their batting average and their team batting average. And you might wonder, what the fuck is a batting average as relates to Jeopardy? And my friends, my good friends out there, who I love, everyone that is listening to me talk about Jeopardy still, J Archive has you covered on that, because if you click any of these nonsense, meaningless terms on their website, you get booted onto the best webpage on the internet, which is j-archive.com/help, and it is an extensive and comprehensive glossary of Jeopardy fan community jargon for mathematically analyzing Jeopardy. We've got the batting average, which you can actually probably figure out. It's just the, you know, ratio of correct responses they gave divided by the total number of responses. You can sort of map baseball onto that. But like I said, Coriat score earlier. What the fuck is that? Well, it's a player's score if all wagering is disregarded. In the Coriat score, there's no penalty for forcing correct responses on daily doubles, but correct responses on daily doubles earn only the natural values of the clues, and any gain or loss from the final Jeopardy round is ignored. It's named for the Season 12 two-game champion, Carl Coriat, who conceived of a scorekeeping method that would allow Jeopardy hopefuls playing along at home to gauge their scores against the contestants playing on the show. Thanks, Carl Coriat. Thanks, buddy. And that itself links to a very long essay called So You Want to Be a Jeopardy Contestant, written by Carl Coriat, which I'm not going to get into right now because we're still on my favorite webpage, jarchive.com/help. We've got Boyd's Rule, Breakpoint, Bridges Rule. I'm sorry, Bridges' Rule. Category, Clavin's Rule. Combined Coriat, Crush. Daily Double, Faith Love. What? Falk's Law. What is Falk's Law? Let's grab that one at random. Oh, that's a pessimistic adage in a similar vein to Murphy's Law. It states that the likelihood of supplying the correct response to a daily double or the final Jeopardy is inversely proportional to the percentage of money wagered on such a clue. Whatever. Fearful Wager? 4/5. That's just a fraction that's on here. Okay. The Forest Bounce. They have something called the Forest Bounce, everybody. Why am I recording this? I don't know. Why do I derive this much enjoyment out of stumbling upon the Jeopardy fan community, which to my knowledge exists on a single website that looks like, other than plugging numbers in for new episodes, has not been updated since 2003. I don't know, but I'm so excited about this, and I need to share it with the world, this excitement that I'm feeling. But back to the game we were looking at, Monday, September 8th, 1986, show 456, episode 87, the first game of season 3. Let's just take a quick scan through these questions. Actually, you know what? Let's not look at the questions for the moment. Let's look at the game dynamics, because of course J Archive has your back if you want a mathematical analysis of how the contestants performed over time. They have a line graph that breaks down everybody's score over time, and you can see that at the about 37 minute mark, because apparently Jeopardy was an hour long show in the 80s. Okay, sure. Is it an hour long show now? I thought it was only a half hour. But around the 37 minute mark, the contestant Susan Sackett, who's just listening to Susan on most of this, just fucking took off. And, you know, everyone else is struggling to break 2,000. She just blasts right through the ceiling, and she gets up to $5,400 by the final Jeopardy. She annihilates the other two people on the episode. Not enemies, but her opponents. Florence Cohen, she only made $400. And Sandra Cheltenham, she did a little better, but she only got $1,600. Susan did geometrically better than the other two people. She was the first champion of the season and completely blew it away. It's incredible. And she did not come back for another episode. She is not a returning champion. She said, you know what? I just crushed this motherfucking board game, and I'm dropping the mic, and I'm just strolling out, both middle fingers in the air. I don't even give a shit. She did not come back for the Tournament of Champions, because I don't think she qualified for that, because she was only a one-time champ. She started the show with a showstopper on Jeopardy Season 3. And I actually have not read most of these questions. Let's take a look. I want to see what some of these questions were. You can, of course, let's see. There's also an option to suggest corrections to all of this, so presumably this was made by a lot of people submitting things. Let's grab one here. I want to see one that like Susan got right that everyone else got wrong or something. Well, let's see. For $200 in the first round, the question was the minimum age for... Oh, these are just the answers, I guess. Shit, Oh, no, I see. Okay. The answer, because, of course, Jeopardy is a game show from the mirror dimension where everything's backwards, the answer was minimum age for a congressman. The correct answer was what is 25, but everyone got it wrong. Susan suggested 35. Sanders suggested 35. Susan said 21. God, okay. All right. I'm getting a little too excited about this, and it's damaging the quality of the product that I'm putting together right now, which was not high to begin with. So I need to once again just take a deep breath here. Okay, I'm good. We're going to just calmly peruse these questions and find a funny one instead of one where I'm just reading numbers into a microphone. Let's see. There was a kids TV category. Let's see. The cartoon featuring this group used Scatman Crothers as voice of Meadowlark Lemon. And, of course, everyone knows that that's the Harlem Globetrotters, except any of the people on this episode. No one even... No, two people buzzed in, but nobody got it right. Sandra thought it was... She said, who are the... And then just stopped. Susan thought it was the Cosby Kids. It's a different cartoon about... listen, okay... it's not the same thing, Susan. And then there was Star of Charlie, AT&T commercials, and Rod Brown of the Rocket Rangers. Rangers! We finally did it! We made a tenuous connection to Teenagers with Attitude. I have now justified why this has showed up in your podcast feed, because I said the word Rangers. Rocket Rangers would be a good name for a season of Power Rangers. I'm a little lightheaded because I'm talking a lot and not taking a lot of breaths. Sandra got that one right, though. It was Cliff Robertson. At 600, this is the last kids TV question we got. Years after playing a circus boy, he made a monkey out of himself. And the answer to that was Mickey Dolenz, but Susan knew that. She nailed it. That was the other thing. Susan got every daily double. And she got them all right. She fucking destroyed it. Let's see. Let's go through the Daily Doubles. We got the two cast members of Webster who fit the category. And the category is Lewis and Clark. And she correctly said Emmanuel Lewis and Susan Clark. I sure as shit couldn't have said that. So good job, Susan, knowing more than me. Where are the other Daily Doubles on here? Oh, this one was an audio clue. Country that's the title of the following. And then I assume there was an audio clue that this website is not equipped to show. But the answer, the question was, what is Brazil? Susan knew it. And the last one here in the category of physiology, of the ear bones called hammer, anvil, and stirrup, the one that looks most like its namesake. Shit, I would guess maybe hammer. I don't know, let's mouse over and see what the real answer was. It was stirrup, and Susan knew it, and I didn't, and I just lost a daily double. Susan, you are still winning at this episode of Jeopardy 30 years later. You're still dominating it. And then we got the final Jeopardy question. Wherein? The category was business and industry. And the answer was world's number one maker of infant formula. This company does 98.2% of its business outside its home country. Haven't mastered over yet. Everyone at home, make your guess. I'm pretty sure it's Nestle. Let's find out. Fuck yeah, it was Nestle. All right. I didn't bet anything, though. And also, I live in the future, so my answer is irrelevant. But you know whose answer wasn't irrelevant? Fucking Susan. But you know what? She was already dominating this game so fucking hard that she only bet $200 because she didn't need the win. She knew full well it didn't matter. Meanwhile, Florence also got the right answer, Nestle, but she didn't bet any money. She was only in third place, so she was really didn't have that much money to bet with in the first place. So it really didn't matter, and she may as well just sat the question out. I respect, Florence, that you didn't waste our time with some kind of dumbass joke answer that would have just wasted Alex Trebek's time, wasted the TV audience in 1986's time, and wasted my time right now. Florence, you're a good, gracious loser, and I respect you. Even though you're bad at Jeopardy. Sandra, on the other hand, thought it was fucking Gerber, so fuck her! Alright, so that's a very brief summation of this episode of Jeopardy. Now, at this point, with Susan dominating this score so much, and then making the choice to not come back, she attained a bizarre, legendary sort of status to me, and I had to know who she was. I had to! So, her last name is only mentioned at one point on this webpage, so I missed it at first, so I just started off Googling Susan Jeopardy 1986. And as you might expect, I didn't get a lot of good results. Got absolutely nothing. I'm pulling it back up again to try and jog my memory to see if I remember. I'm trying to see if there's anything coincidentally correct from what I've found later, which I'll circle back to in a second here. Does not look like it. You know what? I have gotten multiple pictures of contestants, and the video is, it's an image on Google Image Search, and it's muddy enough that it does look like it's probably from the 80s or maybe even the 70s version of the show, but I can see their names clearly. This one has Dave, Ed, Elizabeth, and Brian. No fucking Susan there, Google. What are you doing? This one's got Jerry, John, and Lorraine. Not even an S name in there. Come on! This one's too blurry. I can't tell. So, okay, I'll grant you that one, Google. But, yeah. This one's got Roland, Ann, and Hardy. Google! I've seen Deep Dreamin'. Why is your Google dreaming about dogs and not about Susan the Jeopardy contestant from 1986? That's what I don't understand. I don't see why it can't see that I wrote the word Susan, and then see that there is text in an image, but not text of the word Susan, and leave it out. It's horseshit, and you can do better. Fuck it. Anyway, so, then I've realized that I did in fact have her last name, and I did a search for Susan Sackett. And you know, it came up a Wikipedia page on Susan Sackett. And I thought, surely this is a coincidence. But it's not! Susan Sackett has a Wikipedia page! And you know why she has a Wikipedia page? Because she's a writer for the original Star Trek series! She wrote on Star Trek! This does not seem to have immediate information on which episodes of the TV show she was on. Oh, no, I see. She was not... Okay, she was Gene Roddenberry's personal executive assistant and a production assistant on Star Trek The Motion Picture, and was also involved in the next 5 Star Trek films. I see. Okay, she wrote some episodes for The Next Generation, though. She wrote Menage a Troy. Boy, that's pretty racy there, Susan. And The Game. I don't know anything about Star Trek. What's The Game about? Is it about Jeopardy? Because she's a fucking expert at Jeopardy. I have no idea what this screenshot on Wikipedia about the Star Trek The Next Generation episode The Game is. It looks like an all-red twister mat with, like, a bad 90s CGI, like, blue bullhorn. Like, the kind that an old like 19th century dude would stick in his ear to hear better. And then there's like a frisbee that looks like a target flying over it. And this is like all on a bed or something. What is the fuck with Star Trek? God. Anyway, what's it about? Let's see. Riker returns from a vacation in Risa with a game that he's eager to share with the crew. Unfortunately, the game is psychologically addictive, making the crew suffer from virtual reality addiction, and it quickly turns virtually every member of the Enterprise's crew into mind-controlled pawns of the Katarians, who are using the devices to gain control of Starfleet. After Data, who is an android, is unaffected by the game, inexplicably is incapacitated, only visiting Starfleet Academy cadet Wesley Crusher and young engineering ensign Robin Leifer stand in the way of the insidious scheme. There are three people unaffected by the scheme. That is how many contestants there are on Jeopardy. I think that if you watch this episode, which I've never seen because I don't give a shit about Star Trek, it will be clearly a parallel for Susan Sackett's appearance on Jeopardy. In 1986, there's no other possible explanation. She was drawing directly from experience and encoding it into her writing. Speaking of encoding it into her writing, she wrote a book in 1982, 4 years before she destroyed Jeopardy and left a smoking crater on NBC's primetime lineup. Is Jeopardy primetime? I don't care. I think it's like 7:30. That might be too early for primetime. But she wrote a book called You Can Be a Game Show Contestant and Win. I haven't Googled that book yet because I've just enjoyed the title so much in the context of the story. Well, let's look it up. You Can Be a Game Show Contestant and Win. Here it is on Amazon.com. It costs a penny. It's the one to winner, I guess. The title on the front is in all lowercase. And, between contestant and the word and, there is a, like, double dash, not a Mario Kart, but, like, two hyphens together. let's see. Do we have a description of the book? We have an author biography, which I'm good. I understand Susan Sackett now. She's a Jeopardy monster that consumes game shows and then, evacuates Star Trek episodes as a waste product. But where is what this actual episode, not episode, this book is actually about? Getting too excited again. I'm not seeing like a synopsis of the book. So that's a shame, but there's one customer review. And you know how many stars it's got? You already know how many stars it's got. It's got 5 fucking stars! Because Susan Sackett is a winner in Jeopardy and in books. It was written by Art Kurtz in March of 2000. And he says, while some of the shows in this book no longer exist, the premise is still the same with almost all TV game shows. This book tells you how to get on and how to win. The logical suggestions can be applied to most any game show's concept. And in the world of game shows, and TV in general, everything old is new again. Some of the game shows in this book will probably be back. Excellent point, Art. And you know what? Susan had... She wrote the fucking manual on how to Moneyball Jeopardy. She broke Jeopardy before she ever even thought of getting on that show. And then in her Wikipedia article, it says she went on Jeopardy to prove the point she was making in her book. She had Alex Trebek dead to rights years before they ever met. She is a hero and a legend, and she eats Jeopardy and shits out Star Trek. And God bless you, Susan Sackett. I don't really know who you are, and for all I know, you might be a huge D-bag, because this I just heard about you like 2 hours ago. I have no idea if those 2 Star Trek episodes are any good. Honestly, the game sounded kind of shitty. Screw it, what are we doing? Let's check out Menage a Trois. Ugh. This one has a much longer plot synopsis. At a reception aboard the Federation Starship Enterprise, following a trade conference in Beta Zed, Counselor Deanna Troi argues with her mother, Luoxana Troi, about her insistence that Deanna get married and raise a family. At the same party, Luoxana is approached by the Ferengi Diamond Tog of the ship Kraton, who's interested in Luoxana in a sexual way, but also explains he would like Luoxana to use her telepathy to help him make business, which I assume means take a shit. This alien has boarded the Enterprise because he wants the empath lady's mom to help him poop. Luoxana rejects him flatly and later remarks that she would rather eat Orion wing slugs than date Tog. Afterwards, at the urging of Captain Picard, Commander Rikard and his one-time flame Deanna decide to take a quick short leave on Beta Zed, while the Enterprise heads out on a routine mission studying a nebula. Luoxana tracks down her daughter and Riker, with intent to encourage a renewed romance between the couple. She's just getting started with Diamond Tog arrives, stating that he's come for Luoxana. When he's again rebuffed by Luoxana, please stop saying her name, it's very awkward to say, and I'm probably saying it wrong because it's got a fucking LW at the start of it. That's not how words work, Susan. I know it's a sci-fi show, but English has a certain collection of phonemes that we're used to saying, and Lua is not one of them. I know that you're a hyper genius that could probably destroy Watson in his sleep, because you know that the game isn't played on the court, but before you get there, you would smother that computer in his bed with a pillow. But you have to understand that the rest of us are just human beings, and you gotta use easier to say words for us. That whole thought really just rolled away from me there. Tog has himself and the others transported above the Kraton, leaving a confused Mr. Hammond to wonder where his employer has gone. The three awaken in a cell above the Kraton. Tog then has Deanna and Luoxana beamed into the lab of Ferrick, a Ferengi doctor who hopes to study Luoxana's telepathy using mind probes. In the process of transporting them, he leaves the woman's clothing behind, saying that women are not worthy enough to wear to wear clothes. Alright, you know, Susan, I'm beginning to suspect that you're working out some issues in this Star Trek episode. Luoxana pretends to be interested in Tog and gains Deanna's trust, And gains Deanna's return to the cell with Riker by agreeing to discuss with Tog a proposal to use her telepathic abilities in trade negotiations, by which she means trading shit from his own butt to the toilet. Riker entices a Ferengi guard into a chess game. God, Susan, you can do better than that. And once outside the cell, Riker quickly overpowers the guard. Okay, you know what? You flipped it on me. You flipped it. I was thinking you were doing something lame and cliche even for its time, but then you fucking had him reverse it. And he was using the chess game as a ruse. Just beat up that guard. It's genius. Once freed, Deanna and Riker attempt to send a message to the Enterprise, only to learn that the ship's communication system is secured by access code. As Luoxana seduces Tog by rubbing his ears, she receives a telepathic message from Deanna asking her to try to get Tog's access code. Luoxana has nearly gotten Tog to tell her the code when Ferrick walks in and catches her in the act of rubbing his ears. Ferrick threatens to humiliate Tog by revealing his incompetence, more like incontinence now that he's getting, you know, this shit therapy, to the Ferengi, but offers to forget the incident of Luoxana is turned over to him for experimentation, despite the fact that the proposed test may be lethal. Meanwhile, the Enterprise leaves the Nebula, which has been interfering with communications, and learn from the from Beta Zed officials that Riker and the Troys have been kidnapped. Returning to Beta Zed, the Enterprise crew discovers flowers indigenous to a Ferengi planet at the spot where Deanna and Riker were last seen. Picard orders a frequency scan to see if Riker has somehow sent a message, but are unable to pick up anything discernible. In fact, Riker is tapped into the system on the Kraton that suppresses Cochrane distortion from the ship's warp field and modulated it to generate a signal using unsuppressed distortion into a pattern he hopes the Enterprise crew will recognize. In the midst of the search, acting ensign Wesley Crusher is in final preparation to depart to Earth for his second attempt to pass the Starfleet Academy entrance exam. Just as he's about to leave, he realizes that the modulated interference itself may be the signal and rushes back to the bridge, missing his transport back to Earth. Decoding the signal, young Crusher finds Riker has provided the heading of the Kraton, and the Enterprise heads out in pursuit. See, so she's even got, like, character development for Wesley Crusher in here. I've never fucking watched Star Trek because I don't care about it, but the guy that played him talks a lot on the internet. I think some people like him. I don't fucking know. I think other people don't. Whatever. In the midst of the search acting in... No, I already read that paragraph. In the meantime, Deanna's experiencing great pain as she senses the mind probes being used on her mother. Riker, having finished setting up the modulation of the Cochrane distortion, arms himself and bursts into Ferrick's lab to free Lwaxana. But a standoff ensues when Tog enters with a phaser. Just when the Enterprise arrives, and Lwaxana buys the... What did that burp smell? Oh, it was egg salad. That's right, I ate egg salad. That's what that taste was. And Lwaxana buys the release of Troy and Riker by agreeing to stay with Tog and serve him both as a lover and a business partner. After Riker and Deanna return to the Enterprise, Picard begins to play the role of a jealous lover, describing the love for Lwaxana and telling Tog that if he cannot have her, then no one will, and threatens to destroy the Kryton if she's not delivered to him immediately! Fearing for his life, Damon Tog hurriedly beams Lwaxana directly to the Enterprise bridge and leaves the area post-haste. So taken is Lwaxana by Picard's poetic profession of love for her that she takes her place on his lap in the command chair, causing Picard to quickly tell Ensign Crusher to set course for Beta Zed, almost whispering Warp 9. Crusher is told that he'll be allowed to reapply for entrance to Starfleet Academy in 1 year, and Picard gives him a field promotion to full Ensign in light of his contribution to the shipping crew. I mean, there was a lot of weird, like, sexual tension in that episode description, and I don't know if that's normal for Star Trek, because I don't care about it, so I don't watch it. But other than that, that sounded like a pretty solid episode of Star Trek to me. You had, you know, you learned about the history of Riker and Troy and Troy's weird sexy mom that Picard, I guess, doesn't think is sexy. So you learned more about Picard. Maybe you didn't. Maybe that's an established fact. Is Picard, like, notably not a sexy man? That would make sense if they're trying to get away from Captain Kirk. I don't know anything about Star Trek because I don't watch it because I don't care. But you had, like, the development charactering for Wesley Crusher and the back and forth of, "Aw, Dip, I gotta go away from the ship to go be a college boy. Oh, but I can't because I solved the mystery. Oh, but now I can't get into the college. Oh, but Picard's making me a good boy on the team anyway. It's great. You've got that's everything. Susan, you're amazing. What are these notes here? Ethan Phillips, who makes a Star Trek debut in this episode as a Ferengi, would later go on to become a regular on Star Trek Voyager, playing the character Neelix. The guy that played Neelix got his start on Susan's episode. A screenshot from this episode where Picard quotes from Shakespearean sonnets became infamous as the basis of the What the Fuck Picard theme. Wait. Okay, for a second I thought it might be the facepalm, but no, it is... I have seen this image before of Picard with his mouth open and just gesturing at the camera. Susan invented a meme through time with this episode. She wrote the words that... Shit, what's Picard's actor's name? He's a very well-regarded actor that I like in other things. What the fuck is Professor Xavier's name? Oh, no. Oh, God. It's Patrick Stewart! It's Patrick Stewart, everybody! That's his name! She made a meme in this episode with Patrick Stewart and whoever directed it. Scenes on Beta Zed were filmed in the Huntington Library Botanic Garden. Cool. Yeah. I'm running out of steam. But the point is that Jeopardy rules. The Jeopardy fan community fucking rules. Susan Sackett is amazing. And she walked into Jeopardy season 3 and said, "No, fuck this." And she just dropped a goddamn atom bomb on it. And Alex Trebek could do nothing but shield himself from the atomic blast. That's probably why he's still such a great host today, that her atomic destruction of his game show exposed him to radiation that made him a great game show host. I bet those first two seasons of Jeopardy sucked until Susan showed up. Everything's wonderful. I love the world. I love you. And I'm gonna go to sleep now. Goodbye. Talked for over a half hour to myself about a Jeopardy contestant from the 80s. Made myself a little hoarse. I lost on Jeopardy.